from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Robert Mueller was consistent on one point during his congressional testimony last week. Russian interference in U.S. elections is one of the most serious threats to democracy he says he's seen in his long career. Take this exchange with Texas Republican Will Hurd before the House Intelligence Committee on Wednesday.
In your investigation, did you think that this was a single attempt by the Russians to get involved in our election, or did you find evidence to suggest they'll try to do this again?
No, it wasn't a single attempt. They're doing it as we sit here. And they expect to do it during the next campaign.
The very next day, the Senate Intelligence Committee released a bipartisan report saying that Russia probably attempted to infiltrate election systems in all 50 states. Well, last week, too, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell blocked election security bills that made it out of committee with bipartisan support. So a moment of potential bipartisanship is becoming partisan anyway as the 2020 election looms. So this hour on Point, what is happening to election security legislation on Capitol Hill? And you can join us. Where do you stand on this? Do you think Congress may be asleep at the wheel and distracted by partisan battles? The White House says they've done everything necessary to protect the ballot box across America. Do you agree? And what more do we need to do if you think we need to do anything at all? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, in a moment, we'll hear from Congressional Democrat Zoe Lofgren of California and Republican Rodney Davis of Illinois about their respective election security bills. But first, let's start with Karoon Demirjian. She joins us from Washington, congressional reporter focusing on national security, and she's been covering the story of election security, and we have links to her reporting at onpointradio.org. Welcome to On Point.
Good to be with you.
So first of all, let's just start with the Senate Intelligence Committee report, just to lay the groundwork here for why these bills are so important. Just why was what was revealed last week by the Senate Intelligence Committee so stunning about the all 50 states potentially having been infiltrated by the Russians?
Well, the breadth of what they wrote was in many ways things that we had learned about along the course of watching this. But to have the final stamp of the Senate Intelligence Committee is what made that significant. It's the only bipartisan probe on Capitol Hill to actually look into it and to actually endorse, to have their investigation endorse the extent of the Russian meddling, the purpose for it, the fact that it's probably going to be continuing, all of those matters, that says, okay, it gives it the gravitas and the heft of a fact that cannot be easily disputed between the parties who seem to like to bicker over almost everything that is involved in the election security question regarding the 2016 election because it has become so politically closely tied to the legitimacy of Trump's presidency. Mm. So the report detailed both the extent of the operation, the fact that it tapped all 50 states. It also got into recommendations for how what mistakes the federal government had made in terms of not communicating enough with enough urgency to the states that were actually running elections, when they should be concerned, issuing recommendations for what types of new equipment and new safety protocols and procedures should be implemented to guarantee that this doesn't happen in the future, or at least to safeguard against it, and also recommendations to the federal government to communicate what the consequences will be to any foreign actor that tries to interfere in elections, because the presumption is that it's not just Russia that's going to be looking at this as an option in the future. Mm.
So we have this this report, the first of several reports that the Intelligence Committee is going to put out. We had what Mueller said last week as well. And then, as mentioned, while all this is going on, a little earlier in the week, some election security bills got blocked in the Senate. So first of all, Karen, just tell us what's the biggest and most far-reaching bill that Senator Mitch McConnell decided he did not want the Senate to take up?
Well, what the senators, what Democratic senators for the most part, are trying to do is get these bills that would make various reporting requirements of how you're supposed to alert the authorities when there are entreaties made by foreign governments to interfere in elections. Also, to try to get there to be standardized practices of exactly how you would, what types of machinery or what types of equipment would be necessary for basically establishing a standard of safe equipment, the producing verifiable paper ballots, mm-hmm. and things like that. And what has basically happened is that, I mean, look, just to be completely transparent about this, the Congress did approve $380 million last year right. in grants for the states. And they have approved these kinds of, you know, more kind of surface level proposals to push back and say that it's bad to be doing election interference. But they haven't really dug in deeper than that $380 million. They haven't actually gone as far as saying this is exactly what you will do and this is exactly how you will report future instances. And that's where the resistance seems to be coming in. And that's created this standoff, basically, between Democrats like Mark Warner and Amy Klobuchar, who also want to pass legislation, you know, the Honest Ads Act, that would require disclosure of the money that goes towards disclosure of the money that goes towards paying for online advertisements, much like radio and TV advertisements. But there's been pushback from the Republicans, and especially from Mitch McConnell, who has been arguing that basically Democrats are just trying to throw everything they possibly can at, at the problem without really thinking through what the effects might be. And he's also defensive of the Trump administration and keeps saying, look, you'll notice that we're not freaking out about the 2018 election the way we were about 2016. That means Trump has been more responsible than the Obama administration. And so let's just be patient about this. Of course, Democrats are concerned that let's be patient about this means let's not do anything at all. That's really draconian, especially when you're in an environment where about a month ago, I think it was, the president told ABC that, yeah, he might consider taking foreign assistance if it was offered in the future.
Well, Karen, stand by here for just a second, because I want to turn now to Democratic Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren. She joins us from San Jose, California. She represents California's 19th congressional district, and she's chairperson of the Committee on House Administration, which has jurisdiction over elections. She was also the author of the Securing America's Federal Elections Act, or better known as the SAFE Act, which did pass the House on partisan lines in June. So, Congresswoman Lofgren, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Hello.
So, first of all, start by telling us what you Start by telling us what you hope the SAFE Act would accomplish if it was made into law.
Well, it's really simple. Actually, most of the provisions in the bill mirror recommendations by the National Academy of Sciences. It requires states to use voter-verified paper ballot voting systems. It requires cyber and risk mitigation training, maintenance of election infrastructure, enhanced cybersecurity of voter registration systems. It requires risk-limiting audits, which is the gold standard, the best practice tool to ensure the integrity of elections and to confirm outcomes. It requires accountability for election technology vendors and sets cyber security standards and limits. It does provide for grants, a $600 million that has already been appropriated in the House bill would be provided in grants to implement these requirements. As you've mentioned earlier, last year, $380 million, which was authorized years and years ago pursuant to the Help America Vote Act, was appropriated. And the experts have testified to us that to fully harden our systems would take about $1 billion. So with this authorization, we would get to that number.
Well, Representative Lofgren, if I may just jump in here briefly for a moment, and forgive me, but what's your response to the concern that Republican members of the House and the Senate as well say when they say that they believe the SAFE Act, you mentioned standards that it would put out there for election security, that essentially takes power away from states and from local entities that have historically been the arbiters of how elections are run in this country, that they see it as perhaps a creeping nationalization of elections?
Well, it really reflects the state of threat that exists that we've heard from our intelligence community and our law enforcement community. Essentially, foreign actors, we know about Russia, there may be others, are attacking our country, cyber attacks. And we think that an attack on the nation needs a national response. We wouldn't ask the registrar of voters in Santa Clara County to respond to a missile attack by themselves. This is not that dissimilar. We need to harden our systems and understand that this is one of the most important things that we do. To have elections, make sure that every American citizen who votes has their vote counted as caste, and that the will of the people is reflected in our government, not threatened by foreign actors.
So, given that this has passed the House but is facing stiff opposition in the Senate, how do you see any way forward to get around the concerns of your Republican counterparts?
I don't fully understand it. I mean, I'm working on a bill, an anti-propaganda bill, that we passed the Honest Ads Act that they also objected to. I don't want to speak for the Republicans, but it looks like Mitch McConnell is just Mr. No. He ought to listen to the intelligence community that is laying out these threats and letting us know that, they're serious. We know now, for example, that a majority of the voting systems in the United States are operating on Windows 7 that's not even going to have security patches when the election is held. The equipment is vulnerable. Not only the equipment, but the voting rolls, and we ought to do so. We have a responsibility to do something to protect ourselves.
Mm. Well, Representative Zoe Lofgren, Democratic Congresswoman for California's 19th Congressional District and Chairperson of the Committee on House Administration and author of the Securing America's Federal Elections Act, or the SAFE Act. Representative Lofgren, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Karen Demergen, we just have about, Karen, I should say, I'm so sorry, I keep screwing up your name, Karen.
We just
got about 30 seconds here before a break. Just your quick response to what Representative Lofgren there is saying about she doesn't understand why her Republican counterparts aren't getting on board with the SAFE Act.
I think that what her comments illustrate is that the tension between Democrats and Republicans, which is playing out legislatively as tension between the House and Senate, this is what happens when you've got a divided Congress about critical issues. And of course, this one hits home because we're looking down the pike at an election season again, and people are worried about a repeat of what happened in 2016.
Well, when we come back, we will hear from a Republican congressman about his ideas for election security. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about election security bills that are pending in Congress right now and what's preventing them from moving forward and what we need to do legislatively, if anything, to secure America's elections. I'm joined today by Karen Demergen. She's a congressional reporter focusing on national security, and she joins us from Washington. And joining us now from Collinsville, Illinois, is Rodney Davis. He's a Republican congressman for Illinois' 13th district, which includes Bloomington and Springfield. He's also the ranking member on the Committee on House Administration. He voted against Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren's SAFE Act. We heard from Representative Lofgren just a couple of minutes ago, but Representative Davis has his own proposals for election security and again joins us now. Representative Davis, welcome to you.
Well, thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it. And if I could note, I'd like to send my thoughts and prayers and our condolences to Zoe Lofgren, chairperson of our committee, on the tragedy that happened in our district yesterday in Gilroy.
Yeah, appreciate that very much, actually, Representative Davis, and thank you for remembering that. So let me turn to the issue of election security here now. What is it about Representative Lofgren's SAFE Act that you didn't think deserved your support? Why did you vote against it?
Well, I debated this issue. Number one, we were sitting down with the majority, with Chairperson Lofgren's staff and my staff, and working out what we thought was going to get to a bipartisan bill, and they abruptly walked away from the table. Told me that there was going to be a top-down approach from the majority, and unfortunately, the bill that was put before us was a bill that didn't address the concerns that were raised by the Mueller report. It didn't address concerns raised by our intelligence communities. And And it really wasn't the best approach. Our bill, we believe, was a good continuing step to what we're already doing in Congress to work to ensure that we have safe elections like we did in 2018.
So, but tell me more, though, about why it seems you've been quoted elsewhere as saying that you think that the SAFE Act was taking power away from state and local jurisdictions and how they run elections. Why do you say that?
I say that because I sat down with the election authorities in my district, both Republicans like me and Democrats, who all they want to do is make sure that every one of their citizens who has a right to vote has a chance to vote, and that they're counted fairly and the results are reported. They don't want a top-down approach. We've encouraged other members of Congress in both parties to sit down and have the same type of election roundtable that I had. And when you look at this bill would mandate a certain type of paper ballot machine. When the majority's own witnesses have even told us in the lone hearing that we had on election issues that digital recording machines, DREs, with voter-verified paper ballot audit trails are absolutely safe. Many of my communities, many communities across this nation have invested thousands upon thousands and in some cases billions of their local taxpayer dollars upgrading their machines, making sure they're safe. And this Democratic bill that passed with just one Republican vote, this Democratic bill would outlaw those machines in the year 2022 or 2023.
Mm. Do you oppose the idea of any kind of paper ballot or actual paper trail versus purely electronic voting?
No, we want a paper trail. Okay. What this bill required was, I would call it the Optical Scan Machine Producer Enrichment Act. They require a certain type of paper ballot that would be sold and then put into an optical scan machine. We don't know what the safest technology is going to look like in 10 years. We know from the Democrats' own witnesses that millions of dollars being spent on DRE machines with paper audit trails are, in their words, absolutely safe. I don't understand why the majority wants to continue to put partisanship over election security. When we've actually seen much progress, we've seen $380 million in investments. Our communities are working with the Department of Homeland Security, with the federal government to ensure that elections were safe. And we saw that in 2018. And I don't know why the Democrats don't want to acknowledge that and want to just move with a very, very nationalistic approach.
So then, Representative Davis, tell me a little bit more about specifically your own election security legislation and how you think it's better than the SAFE Act.
Well, number one, we're not going to legislate specific standards because we've already empowered the Election Assistance Commission to produce their Voluntary Voting Systems Guideline 2.0. That's going to address their concerns. We have already acted and told that agency that has jurisdiction over election issues to do a study. Let's let them do their work. Let's not force a top-down approach. These are the types of issues that we've been working with, along with how in the world are we going to be able, as the federal government, tell local authorities that they need to get rid of machines that have paper audit trails that have been deemed absolutely safe by Democratic witnesses in our hearing. Why are we telling them to get rid of those in just a couple of years? Mm. Those are just two problems I have. But the main problem I have is the majority knows full well that we were willing participants in bipartisan negotiations, and they stood up and they walked away. That's not what the American people want when it comes to fixing election security issues in this country ahead of 2020.
I suppose highly partisan acts, the American people have become rather used to seeing that happen from both sides of the aisle. But let me just ask you to respond to something specifically that Representative Lofgren just told us, that, you know, she sees she sees Russian interference in the U.S. election as a major attack. I mean, that's language that's been echoed by other people, not just the representative. And she made the analogy of that we wouldn't ask a local jurisdiction to respond on its own if it had been attacked by a missile. I mean, I think do you see it as that as analogous to that? And perhaps if you do, don't we need some kind of national level response to a national level threat?
Well, we're already working on it at the national level. We've already empowered our Department of Homeland Security to work with election officials. And their bill, H.R. 2722, the bill that Chairperson Lofgren talked about, did not even address a simple issue like giving our election officials security clearance. I found out through the development process of this bill that our DHS officials, our DOD officials, can't even talk to certain election officials in this country if they see that there's nefarious activity coming to their jurisdiction because they don't have the necessary government clearance. Our bill addressed these things. Their bill did not, and they voted down every amendment that we put forth to try and make changes to their bill, just like they did with the 622-page behemoth that they introduced on the first day of Congress without anybody reading it, and also bragging about working that bill with special interest groups from the outside. They didn't allow a single Republican amendment to be added at our committee, and that's disappointing because our committee's traditionally been bipartisan.
Well, Representative Rodney Davis, a Republican congressman for Illinois' 13th District, joining us from Collinsville, Illinois. Representative Davis, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Karen Demergen from The Washington Post, thanks for your patience there in listening to Representative Davis. Just respond to what you just heard him say. It seems as if his objections were along the lines of political process versus concerns about the basic issue of election security.
Well, he's making the point that, you know, to mandate one thing across all 50 states may run up against states' rights because this isn't necessarily something that the framers thought about back in the day. But the problem is that if you spend the time doing studies, he's right. Technology does advance in 10 years to a place where we don't know where it's going to go. However, the problem with the election security seems to be that the reliance on technology has created these potential weak points that people can exploit and hack. And so that's why you saw in the Democrats' bill this reliance on verifiable paper ballots, on saying you're not going to have those machines hooked up to anything like the internet when they're actually working, and these concerns to kind of pull off the technological advancement grid back to things that are, you know, more difficult to quote unquote hack, even if they are more antiquated in terms of, you know, how developed they are. Yes, paper is not that crazy forward, but it is something that has always been kind of relied upon as the last measure of reference. I think that you do have tension between Republicans and Democrats about negotiating this issue, that you always have. But again, like I said, this is not like this bill and this negotiation was the first time that people started to try to talk across mm-hmm. party lines about the issue. We have been doing this since before the 2016 election, and we have never been able to completely politically separate it from the political reality of what happened in 2016 in terms of who won, who lost, who felt like their ballots were misrepresented, and which states became the swing points. It's impossible when you have a federal election to completely say it's okay for the states to make their own judgment calls because it is a federal election that it affects. But negotiating this balancing act between how many demands to make without completely taking it out of the hands of the states and how to kind of make everybody be able to come to a center point where they agree is difficult. Even in the Senate mm-hmm. report that you saw, they recommended a study of how the $380 million that's already been approved for grants has been used before you talk about issuing new funds so that you can actually help pay for some of these measures that are being discussed. They don't even say specifically, this is exactly how much money we should put out there and exactly what it should pay
right.
for.
So I'm going to get to a couple of calls here really quickly. But Karen, before I do, fact check something with me, because you heard Representative Davis say that that, you know, local election officials couldn't, they don't even have the security clearance to talk to members of the intelligence community if they have concerns about election security in their jurisdictions. Point taken, but don't I also, if I recall correctly, Republican members of Congress were objected to a Democratic proposal that say members of campaigns would have to report to the FBI if they feel as if they had been contacted by foreign adversaries. And that even just that proposal met significant Republican concerns. Is that right?
Right. I mean, they're addressing slightly different things. Yeah. The mandate that would be in the bill that I believe Senator Warner backed in the Senate, and I'm forgetting, apologies, who backed it in the House, is that would say, look, if you are approached by a foreign entity, you know, your job is to report it to the FBI, because maybe there's a little bit of, you know, ambiguity about where the laws are on that. But let's just make it crystal clear that you have to do that. Otherwise, there are going to be penalties if people find out later that you were approached and accepted foreign assistance that you didn't report to the authorities. What Representative Davis was referring to, and I was trying to look this up really quickly because I do remember Homeland Security officials telling Congress about this, there was a problem in terms of what state officials would be able to receive emergency security clearance or already have it in order to communicate with the more secretive information, sensitive information that federal officials would have at their disposal in order for them to be able to actually accurately communicate the threat to the state officials who had to know about it. And this is something that DHS raised the alarm about months ago. I was trying to furiously look up and failed to see if it was addressed in some way. If I can do that before the end of the show, I will. But yes, that was a concern about, you know, who at the state level, are there going to be at least two or three officials to whom they can tell federal secrets and have people get that clearance quickly so that if there's a threat that the federal authorities detect, they can tell the states and the states can snap too. If you can't communicate all the information, it makes the line of communication you may have established not worth as much as you might need it to be in a moment of crisis.
I see. Okay, well, let's go to the callers very quickly. Susan's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Susan, you're on the air.
Hi, Magna. Thank you. I've been following this for a while, and my feeling now is that all these political ins and outs and the technological ins and outs, I think it's all a big smokescreen. And what keeps happening is Mitch McConnell seems to think that he doesn't have to allow a vote on election security in the Senate. And it's happened over and over again. It happened to Kamala Harris's bill, which was passed in the House, and he wouldn't bring it up in the Senate. And I would like to know why. Is there some connection between Mitch McConnell and Russia that we don't know about? Is anyone looking at that? It just seems like the rest of all these arguments are just people throwing up sand.
Mm. Well, Susan, thank you so much for your call. I will note that Senator McConnell has historically been fiercely opposed to any increase in federal involvement in local elections. The New York Times noted that back in 2002, during the debate over the Help America Vote Act, Senator McConnell opposed that reform package, which emerged from the vote counting failures of the 2000 presidential election. He just does not like what he sees as, again, he sees as one size fits all approaches to running elections in the 50 states. But let's turn now to Marion Schneider. She joins us from Philadelphia. She's a former Pennsylvania Deputy Secretary for Elections and Administrations and now President of Verified Voting, a national election integrity advocacy group. Marion Schneider, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I did mention Senator McConnell's historic opposition to reform packages when it comes to federal involvement in elections. But are we in a different time now? Do we need some sort of strengthening of legislation from the federal level to protect our election system from foreign interference?
I think it's very important that we have federal standards that apply uniformly across the states. And there is precedent. You mentioned the Help America Vote Act. That's one precedent. And for example, provisional ballots are a procedure that were implemented as a result of the Help America Vote Act and are now present in every state. But that did not mean that the federal government took over elections. Elections are still run at the state level. And there's other earlier federal legislation relating to when states can remove voters from voter registration lists. So we do have precedent. And I agree with the comments earlier in the show that we were attacked in 2016. And this is not a partisan issue. It's a matter of national security. And we need to stand shoulder to shoulder and defend ourselves.
Mm, but it has become a partisan issue, right? Because as you heard Representative Davis say, he just doesn't believe that the ideas that the Democratic members of Congress are putting forward are in the best interests of states, first of all. And second of all, was very concerned about the idea of the federal government mandating things like the very types of voting machines that are used across the country. Your response to that?
So I think what I heard from Representative Davis was that he was concerned that the legislation was overly prescriptive, but that, and I mean, I can see what he's talking about, but by the same token, we know what we need to do to make our voting systems resilient. And I differ with him when he talks about direct recording electronic computers, even with a voter verifiable paper audit trail, are secure enough. We don't agree that they're secure enough because they tabulate immediately and because the voters may not look at those paper ballots. They're really not ballots. They may not look at the receipts that the device prints, and therefore you won't have a trustworthy record. And I don't believe in the hearing that was held, because I attended that. I testified during that hearing. I don't believe anyone said those were just as good. Uh-huh. I think what was being discussed was newer technology. So I think that we know that we need a trustworthy record. We know that that record has to be a voter-marked paper ballot, and we have to look at it after the fact with an audit.
Well, Marian Schneider and Karen Demergen, stand by here for a second. We'll be right back. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about election security legislation pending on Capitol Hill and what, if anything, we need to do to protect America's election infrastructure from foreign interference. I'm joined today by Karen Demergen. She's a congressional reporter focusing on national security for The Washington Post. Marian Schneider also joins us. She's a former Pennsylvania Deputy Secretary for Elections and Administration, now president of Verified Voting, a national election integrity advocacy group. And let's listen to a little bit about how people at the state level look at this issue, because, of course, they are the ones who are helping make our elections happen every single year. So here's a report from Hearst Television National Investigative Unit reporter Mark Albert. And this is what secretaries of state from both parties told him at their annual conference earlier this month in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Do you need more money for election security?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Look, we absolutely need more money.
We can always use more money for election security.
That was the unanimous verdict of secretaries of state we interviewed at their annual July conference. Paul Pate is the president of the National Association of Secretaries of State and from Iowa, where up to 1 million times a day, hackers probe for weaknesses.
So every plot on this map, and I see them on almost all the continents, they're trying to penetrate your system?
They're trying to penetrate the state of Iowa's government systems.
That report from Hearst Television, National Investigative Unit reporter Mark Albert. And in it, you heard Pennsylvania's Kathy Buchvar, a Democrat, Florida's Laurel Lee, a Republican, Democrat Alex Padilla from California, West Virginia Republican Mack Warner, and Republican Paul Pate, whose state of Iowa's government systems get 1 million attempted intrusions per day. So, Marian Schneider, let me turn back to you here. I mean, you've been in this. You have done this at the state level as well.
Yes.
If you could write a bill right now that you think would be meaningful in substantially increasing election security, what would you include in that bill?
Well, I think that many of the things that I would include are in the bill that passed in the House, the SAFE Act, and also in Senator Wyden's bill. But we need to have uniform standards, cybersecurity standards for elections, but they have to be coupled with funding to make sure that the funding gets down to the level at which we are running elections. It's not only the states that need the funding, but it's all the local jurisdictions that actually run our elections. And I think that's what the secretaries of state were referring to. And I wanted to come back to one other point earlier in the show where we were talking about communications. Mm-hmm. I agree that there needs to be good communication between the federal security agencies and the state election officials. And a lot of progress has been made since 2016 with the designation of elections as critical infrastructure. And I believe even in the Senate report, the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence report, they said 92 officials had that clearance right now. So that should also be codified, and even though it is being carried out. So those are the kinds of things we need: are a voter verified paper ballot coupled with routine, rigorous post-election audits, and the funding to implement both of those things.
Well, let's go back to our callers. Marcus is calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Marcus, you're on the air.
Hi, Magna. So I feel that our leaders have been asleep at the switch for quite some time. British Broadcasting in July of 2013 reported that Russia had spent 10,000 British pounds purchasing typewriters. And so they've had this plan in action and been going after it. Mossad and the Israelis warned us 6 months prior to that that Russia was attempting something, and this is now the fruits of what it is. And it comes down to this is a national security issue. This is not a bipartisan issue. This is in order to protect our democracy and ensure the integrity of our democratic system.
Marcus, thank you for your call. Let's go to Jonathan, who's calling from Stoneham, Massachusetts, I should say. Jonathan, you're on the air.
Hi, Magna. Thank you for taking my call. Just briefly, I want to get your guest's assessment of this idea. It seems like the federal inaction about election security in light of all the evidence of Russian interference violates Article 4, Section 4 of the Constitution. It's the only clause of the Constitution that requires the United States to do something, so the U.S. shall defend the states from invasion, and it shall defend a small-r Republican form of government in each state. So it seems like a foreign adversary interfering in our elections violates the mandate from the Constitution to defend the states on both of those fronts. Mm.
Jonathan, thank you for your call. Karen, do you want to take that? Is there a constitutional mandate here to protect our election system?
Sure, I'll weigh in a little bit on both. I think part of the problem is that you've got a debate about what is the standard, what is the election security, definition that we have of what the threats are, what our responses will be. That's still an ongoing debate in Congress. And so I think that a lot of people would say, yeah, this is no different than some sort of a physical attack on a state that would be, protected under the Constitution, except for that still hasn't been really completely defined, right? Is this just a technological glitch and a weakness, or is this actually something that we're regarding as a national security threat akin to a kinetic threat, akin to a standard weapons sort of threat, or the rise of an invasion? So that's up there. And then your previous caller made the point about, this has been out there for a while. I mean, look, I started with the Post covering, being in the Moscow Russia Bureau. I covered the whole war in Ukraine, and I'm well aware of all the different parts of the world that were very, very cognizant of the way Russia does business. And we just kind of didn't have this attitude that it could affect us in the United States. That was what was going on there in the environs of Russia and its neighbors and in Europe. And we didn't have the imagination to figure out how it might actually hit the United States early on when others were warning that, look, you're not immune, because it was happening there, not here, and that changed in 2016.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Adam, who's calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Adam, you're on the air.
Hi, Magna. Thank you for taking my call. I just have to take a small issue with the previous caller and their characterization of Mitch McConnell blocking election security bills. The most recent bill, if I'm not mistaken, it was asked for unanimous consent in the Senate. And that's not blocking it. They just simply didn't have unanimous consent to move forward on that matter. And furthermore, H.R. 1 that was introduced earlier this year, when I read it, was not simply election security, but contained a whole host of campaign finance reforms that, depending on your view of the Constitution, may have not even held up in court. So when I hear this messaging that Mitch McConnell is blocking all these benefit him or benefit anyone else, I just have to disagree with that.
Adam, thank you for your call. Karen, is that you there?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, technically speaking, it wasn't a surprise that there wasn't unanimous consent for it, but any one senator can block a bill from coming up. When a senator tries to raise on the bill, literally what happens to stop that from happening is somebody objects, which is technically a blocking move. They never put it on the floor for a complete vote, and I think that's what Democrats are really objecting to, that, why can't we just vote on this either up or down, whatever happens, and that's why the technical blocking language is that. But I forget what the second part of it was that the caller was saying, because there was something else in there to respond to.
I think he was talking about H.R. 1, big bill from the Democrats about election security, which he said also included campaign finance reform provisions could have been a problem. Yeah,
it does. But those are not that's not the bill that the senators keep angling for bringing up on the floor. The bills that they're trying to get up are more pinpointed, smaller ones. It's a group. Some of them are just Democrats. A few of them have been co-sponsored in the past. But I mean, by people of both parties. But the push in the Senate is about the many other election security bills that are out there that are focused pretty much exclusively on election security and funding narratives surrounding it.
So, Marian Schneider, let me turn back to you here and let's talk a little bit more about our actual infrastructure from state to state here, because as was noted earlier in the hour, Congress did distribute, what, $380 million to states last year to help with election security upgrades. The SAFE Act would put another $600 million or so out there. But again, I'm seeing here that the New York Times notes that the Brennan Center for Justice wrote a report in March that says that $380 million only scratches the surface because of 121 election officials, the Times points out, in 31 states who reported the need to replace aging equipment before the 2020 election, two-thirds of them say they lack the funding to do so even now. So how vulnerable or antiquated is our election infrastructure from state to state?
Well, you're right, there's a wide variability. And I think that you have to rank it according to vulnerability. So voting systems that do not incorporate a paper ballot are going to be more vulnerable than those that do. And even if they're older, if they have a paper ballot, you can still check them. They can still be resilient to attack. But that we have to think about that $380 million. That was allocated according to the Help America Vote Act allocation, which means the states got a proportion relating to their citizen voting age population. So, for example, Pennsylvania, 83% of their voting systems in 2016 were vulnerable, did not have any paper record at all. And I estimated that it was about between 70 and 90 million just to replace those machines, and they got 14 million out of the 380 million. So that's why the Brennan Center says it just scratches the surface. And also, it wasn't targeted to those states that were most vulnerable. For example, the five states that had all paperless systems, the additional 10 to 13 states that a significant portion of their systems were paperless. So I want to go back to why that is important, because resilience means that you can monitor your systems, that you can detect when something has gone wrong and recover from it. And when you have a system with a paper ballot, you can do that. And then when people say, oh, the election might be rigged, you can say, yeah, that's a risk, but here's the process we've put in place so that even if that risk does happen, we can detect it and we can recover from it. And that's why that's so vital.
Well, Marian Schneider, former Pennsylvania Deputy Secretary for Elections and Administration and now President of Verified Voting, a national election integrity advocacy group, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Karen, before I let you go in the last couple of minutes here, let's pivot for a moment to actually somewhat related issue, because the president, President Trump, has announced via Twitter that the Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, will step down as DNI director on August 15th. And the president has announced that Republican Congressman John Ratcliffe will be nominated to replace Coats. So first of all, Karen, this wasn't entirely unexpected, but is the timing significant, given that we're just coming off the Mueller testimony from last week?
Yeah, I don't think anybody believes that you can separate the two events in the president's head, even though we're not in the president's head. But the Mueller testimony happened. Republicans declared a victory off the back of that. And then the following weekend, the president made this announcement. And there's been tension between President Trump and Dan Coats for a while. Dan Coats is a old school Republican, spent years and years and years in the Senate as a senator from Indiana and was before that a representative. He's been ambassador to Germany. He has people who respect him on both sides of the aisle, and he has spoken his mind, whether it's from, you know, as a witness in committee interviews or just when he's been in public spaces, when he thinks that Trump is saying things that are wrong about the Russian threat, about Iran, about any number of issues that fall under his purview. So there was always that tension there. And because he was pretty disciplined about speaking what he thought to be true, even if it didn't agree with the president, he got accolades from Democrats, but burned. That doesn't sit well with the current president when he's publicly disputed by his team. And so it seemed inevitable that Coats would head toward the exit at some point. And this is the point that was chosen.
Well, I mean, we're seeing here reports that when it came to the particular issue of election security or Russian interference, that the president, as you said, did bristle quite frequently because Coates was so vocal about it, perhaps one of the most vocal in the intelligence establishment.
Right, which you could argue, you know, as we've been debating, why aren't we talking about the substance of what the Russian threat is? That is part of Dan Coats' job as the spy chief, right? To say when the intelligence has detected a threat that's so critical that people need to be warned about it and snap into action. And he deemed the Russian interference threat and other threats to be that. But as we've seen, you know, Coates was possibly one of the most vocal people in the administration about it. But when other members of the administration have been pushed, it's very hard to find any of the cabinet secretary level people that have said, oh, no, I don't think Russian interference is a thing. The president has kind of been on his own island in that he's the one who is consistently pushed back on actually putting all his cards on the table and saying, yes, this is a problem. Coates was just one of the most repeated and insistent people by virtue of his job, really. But of the many people in Trump's administration who have said, no, this actually is really a problem that we have to take seriously.
Mm. Well, the president says he's going to nominate Republican Congressman John Ratcliffe of Texas to be the new director of national intelligence. Now, Representative Ratcliffe did have some pretty tense exchanges with Robert Mueller last week during Mueller's testimony. Here is just a moment of that, when he grills the former special counsel about whether or not Mueller stayed in his lane regarding the purview of the special counsel.
Respectfully, Director, you didn't follow the special counsel regulations. It clearly says write a confidential report about decisions reached. Nowhere in here does it say write a report about decisions that weren't reached.
That's Republican Congressman John Ratcliffe of Texas just last week, and he's referring to the fact that the special counsel didn't come to a conclusion about obstruction of justice. But this has been fact-checked pretty clearly, and federal regulations say that, quote, at the conclusion of the special counsel's work, he or she shall provide the attorney general with a confidential report explaining the prosecution or declination decisions reached by the special counsel. But Karen Demirjian, what kind of person is the president getting if Ratcliffe is confirmed as the new director of national intelligence?
I mean, look, Ratcliffe is a prosecutor by training. He's pretty skilled at sitting at the dais and pulling witnesses into these things. His point to Mueller in that exchange was, you've been saying Democrats have been relying on the fact that you didn't exonerate him, but it wasn't your job to exonerate him. He's innocent until proven guilty. Ratcliffe, though, has been making this case for the GOP that lines up perfectly with what Trump views, that the special counsel's investigation either wasn't done correctly or was illegitimate. There should be more focus on Hillary Clinton. They should be looking more at the origins of the probe, which would potentially undermine Mueller's whole probe. He's been making these lines, using legal arguments to do it. Trump has been in line with that. Trump has applauded that from the sidelines. And Ratcliffe's been consistent. He's been criticizing the FBI since before Trump took office. But this lines up very well with what the president wants and thinks he will get in terms of a loyalist in the DNI position.
Well, Karen Demirjian, congressional reporter focusing on national security for The Washington Post, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.